Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Kevin.
I guess we're going to talk about Patreon a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion out there.
Now that we actually have, you know, some content going on over there, let's talk about Patreon. This, if you're listening to this right now, this is an ad for Patreon, which means you're listening to it on our free podcast. 100% free, will always be free, free all the time. And you're listening to that, so you know that. You didn't pay anything for this podcast. However, we have a supplemental... we have bonus content on a website called Patreon. Patreon.com/KevinTheStrange is where you can go to listen to bonus podcasts from not only Reading to Strangers, but from Watching with Strangers and Ranting at Strangers also. Our other podcasts on the Strangeville Podcast Network.
At certain levels, you also get full audiobooks.
Yeah.
Access to early, you know, written content as well.
Yes. And heavy discounts. My book... I Died in a Bed of Roses is coming out this month, and for everyone else, it's going to be $15 to pre-order that book, signed and shipped from me. For our patrons at the $5 and up level, that book is only going to be $10. You'll be able to get that book signed, personalized from me, and shipped. No shipping cost on your end. We'll have a link to buy that for $10 on our for our $5 and up patrons. So that's just another bonus you get.
So it's like getting the book and a bunch of free content for the same price as just the book.
Like Jeremy said, you get those you get the audiobooks up front before they air serialized on the podcast. We do about 20 to 25 minutes a week of a particular book, but as a $5 and up patron on Patreon.com, you get access to that full audiobook with no commercials, absolutely uncut, unedited, right there up front at the beginning of the month. So right now, you can listen to, if you sign up at the $5 level today, you get to read the entire, or I'm sorry, you get to listen to the entire audiobook of The Humans Under the Bed by Kevin Strange and McHumans by Kevin Strange, and that's over 3 hours of content right there at the $5 level, plus the discounts on the books, plus you get shout-outs at the end of every month for being a patron, and a bunch of other
cool
stuff.
All about value.
And we do that because that's the Patreon is how we fund the operation. We give you free podcasts that don't involve outside advertising. This is our advertising. If you donate even as little as $1 a month, you help us fund the operation, all right? So that's the difference between the free podcast and the Patreon. So we appreciate you listening to this ad. And you got anything to add there, Jeremy?
Just go to patreon.com/KevinTheStrange if you're interested.
Hey, Kevin. What do you want to do about this podcast intro?
For Reading to Strangers?
Yeah.
I always think we download this broody ass music. Then you'd be like, read to strangers. I'd be like, I don't want to read to strangers. I'd be like, read to strangers. I'd be like, I don't want to read to strangers. Then I shoot myself in the head. Pow!
See, I was thinking more like Reading Rainbow's theme song.
Like with LeVar Burton?
Yeah.
Like, take a look. It's in a book. That shit.
Yeah, but like, reading to strangers.
Reading to strangers. Reading to strangers. No, that's a terrible idea. Hey, welcome back to Reading to Strangers. Apparently it's President's Day.
We're gonna
call it Trump Day.
Trump Day.
No. We're not here to be antagonistic this week. This week we're going to try to, hopefully in the preceding 7 days, nothing huge has happened because we're recording this a week early.
Or you just listen to our podcast covering it, special edition, whichever.
Or you just listen to a brand new special edition bombshell podcast.
Where we're talking about shit we really don't want to.
Well, hopefully not. So my name's Kevin Strange.
My name's Jeremy Daniels.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the origin of the book McHumans that we've been listening to this month. Whether anybody's been listening to it or if you've only been listening to the Bizarro Community drama this month, one thing is true is we've still continued to publish audio fiction on the Reading to Strangers podcast all month long. And for those listeners who appreciate that and enjoy that, this is the direction we're going to try to pull this, you know, tooth and nail, pull this podcast into. So let's talk about a couple other things. This week, last week,
yeah,
I turned my final draft of my new novel, I Died in a Bed of Roses, into the editor, Sean Ferrari.
We need to get him on here sometime.
Yeah, I told him he needs to come on and hang out with us. And he will. He's about to have a baby. By the time this podcast airs, I'm sure he's going to have had the baby.
If not, he's at least going out at midnight and getting chocolate cake.
Right. So big shout out to Sean.
We love you and miss you.
He's got the manuscript in his hand, and I've asked him to get that to me before the end of the month. If he can, that'd be great. And we'll have a brand new Kevin Strange book out in the month of February or March at the latest, and that's called I Died in a Bed of Roses. We'll talk a little bit more about it when we put the pre-sale up and really get that going. But it's a paranormal romance book that I'm calling a mutant romance, because it's not fair to categorize.
There's no vampires and werewolves.
It's actually plant mutants.
Plant mutants.
It's a very, very weird book.
You got that art coming at some point?
Yeah, by the time this podcast airs, we should have that art. I was told by the artist working on the cover that I should have at least a rough sketch of the cover by, again, we're recording this a week early, so by this weekend, but when this podcast airs, last weekend. So hopefully we have some stuff to share with you guys. When the Strange Sayings newsletter comes out this month, it's going to have the full cover and the pre-order information for how to pre-order that. And as you heard on the new Patreon ad before this episode aired, when the pre-order goes live for I Died in a Bed of Roses, for everyone else, the pre-order is going to be $15, postage paid for a signed and personalized copy of I Died in a Bed of Roses from Kevin Strange. But for anyone donating $5 or more per month to our Patreon at patreon.com/KevinTheStrange, that pre-order price is actually going to be $10. So for only $10, you can have a signed, personalized, and shipped. Keep in mind, that includes the shipping cost of my brand new book. So that is that's done this week. And I've also been working on next month. For the month of March, we're going to be airing a brand new, never before recorded, so never heard, the audio version has never been heard before of my new book, my new story, Jorek and the Shoggoth Steel. I've also been working on a follow-up story to that. It's actually a prequel story called Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms of Ik.
Hmm.
I'm over 5,000 words into that story now, nearing its end. I've been working on that all week. And I think what we can do, actually, is I think we could do Jorek and the Shoggoth Steel at the beginning of the month. And I think we could actually have, I think I'm going to have this story done, and we could actually record Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms of Ik for the last half of March.
Sounds good to me. March is Barbarian Month.
March will be Barbarian Month. I'll release, we had talked before in January that I was going to release a top seven Kevin Strange's top seven favorite Barbarian movies. I never did do that. We got so caught up in Bizarrogate, I never did publish that article. So for the month of March, we're going to do some real work with Barbarian sword and sorcery stuff. Yeah, I just watched this badass. Do you watch Comic Book Girl 19? On YouTube?
No.
She's a reviewer of comic books. She's really hot. But beyond that, she's really well-informed. Her favorite series is X-Men. And she actually has three feature-length YouTube documentaries about different eras of the X-Men comics. Hmm. She does the Golden Age of X-Men, the Phoenix Saga, and the Dark Phoenix Saga. And she's got voiceovers. There's motion graphics for the comic book panels. And she is awesome at what she does. So if you're into X-Men specifically or into comic book reviews, she does movie reviews also. Check out Comic Book Girl 19. She started a new show called Greater Creators, and the second episode of Greater Creators actually focuses on Frank Frazetta, who did the Sword and Sorcery Conan novel covers and basically like created the look and feel of the sword and sorcery genre of fiction and comic books in the 1960s and 70s. And it's a pretty fascinating documentary, so it's got me all hyped up to finish these barbarian stories. And yeah, we're going to do a whole month.
Well, that's barbarian awesome. Fiction. We'll also be out on the road in March.
Yeah, we're going to get to
do some drinking like barbarians. Yeah,
we will be drinking with barbarians. And I'm going to go ahead and make this announcement now. I know I always make these announcements early, and then I regret it, and I wish I would have announced it later. But there is a good chance that Kevin Strange and Jeremy Daniels at the Strange Fiction table at Horror Hound Weekend in March are going to be joined by the girls of Night Moves.
Hmm.
Night Moves is a Bloomington, Indiana strip club, and several of the strippers from Night Moves, they're horror convention regulars anyway. That's how I met them. But they have a new strip club calendar, and we are going to graciously allow the ladies of Night Moves to sell their stripper calendar at our table. So if you're going,
I think they'll dress up like barbarians.
Oh, I hope so. So
if you're for the website.
So if you're at Horror Hound, be sure to swing by the Strange Fiction table and pick up a night. If they get it done now, I've been told that there's a possibility that this calendar won't be finished in time for Horror Hound. But even if it isn't, you can expect the girls of Night Moves to be hanging out with Kevin and Jeremy. So we will be drinking like barbarians, and we will be joined by the wenches as well. The wenches of Night Moves. So that's an exciting.
That does sound like an exciting comment.
An exciting announcement. I could have waited until March to make that announcement. So we'll let you know in a future podcast if that is definitely happening. So we will confirm or deny the Girls of Night Moves calendar being for sale at the Strange Fiction table at Horror Hound Weekend. So that's what I've been up to lately. And last week on the show, we talked about we spent an hour talking about the controversy of Bizarro Gate, but we then finished the episode with a segment from McHumans, and it's segment number two, and it follows Ricky and Karen and Chef, and what is the little dude's name that gets stabbed with the I can't remember his name. Ty,
there you go.
So Chef and Ty and Karen and Ricky all descend into the depths of Relay, and they actually run into a ritual being performed as they're twisting through the depths of the cavernous non-Euclidean depths of Great Relay. And at the beginning of that segment, Ty actually gets stabbed by these lobster scorpion creatures. He gets stabbed by one, and that doesn't come into play in the last week's segment, but it does come into play in this week's segment. But I really, we're going to talk about the origins of McHumans and why I wrote it, what the point was of the whole thing, why it came out when it did. We'll talk about that after the segment, but I think I can go ahead and talk a little bit about the segment itself from last week. That was actually not included in the anthology version of McHumans. That was a brand new scene that was written specifically for the standalone version of McHumans. So the meat portal, where they walk into the ritual and all the women.
A meat portal special edition.
Yeah. When Ricky and them all walk into that room, that cavern, and all the women are tied up, and they're actually being used as portals, as flesh portals, to bring new creatures from the other side to our dimension. That wasn't included in the original. That was you may have bought the anthology, but here's the special edition. Buy the whole thing. Buy the standalone. So a lot of people don't know that there's actually two versions of McHumans. But this next segment really gets into the meat of the. Of the story, there's some double crossing.
Yes.
There's some tragedy. There's a lot of killing, a lot of death coming up, and some weird monsters. And we'll get into that. Are you ready to do? You have anything you want to add?
I think we're good to throw it in.
So we're gonna go to this third segment of McHumans where we. There's some double crossing, some intrigue, lots of monsters, and a bunch of gross, horrifying, gory death. So we will see you on the other side of the segment, and we are going to discuss the origins of McHumans. Gang, see you on the other side. What's up, you reader fucks? My name's Kevin Strange.
And this is Travis.
And we're here from the Watching with Strangers podcast, because there's other things in the world besides books, too, you bookish fucks. We review cult movies. What kind of cult movies do we review, Travis?
All kinds of cult movies.
Like what?
Cultists of the cult, including Cult from the Future.
Cult movies from the future at kevinthestrange.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever other podcasts fuck, you fucks. Everyone remains quiet as we creep our way through the Cyclopean caverns. The only sound coming from our group is the clump, clump, clump of Karen's twisted right foot as she bounce limps along, doing her best to keep up with the rest of us, and the ragged breathing of our cross-dressing companion, Ty. He looks worse for the wear. He's pale and pouring sweat. We're all sweating under the hollowed-out heads-come-helmets of the sniffers, but Ty is sweating so badly it runs from his monster helmet like drool out of the dead beast's mouth. He clutches his swollen arm. Even through the armor, I can see it has continued to swell. The swelling has made its way into his neck as well. Now it pulses in time with his breathing. Before long, he starts to sway back and forth, clearly in bad shape. I take a drink from a small bottle I have hidden under my carpus armor. Karen eyes it, motioning for me to give her a sip. "You don't want this," I say, stowing it back under my arm. She pulls me close, looking over her shoulder at Ty. "He's not gonna make it. We're gonna have to cut him loose." She's right, of course. Whatever poison resides in the sniffer stingers is killing him, but I still feel obligated to mount some kind of protest in his defense. It is, after all, my crazy plan that got him into this mess to begin with. Before I can form even the most half-hearted argument in Ty's favor, we hear a noise from around a turn in the corridor just in front of us. Or is it behind us? Goddamn relay.
"Get back!"
Chef hisses. We all freeze, letting the fat cook handle the danger. He pulls out his weird stone with the hand not covered in alien sea monster armor. He creeps forward as the noise around the corner grows louder. It sounds like a pair of children giggling underwater. Karen and I take a defensive posture while Ty quietly vomits behind us. Chef turns to us as if to whisper some sort of command, when suddenly he vanishes. One second, he's staring me in the face, the next he's gone. Karen looks at me, puzzled. I run forward as the giggling, gurgling sound gets even louder. Whatever the creatures are, they're almost on top of us. That's when I see him, below me. Somehow the corner of the wall and the floor don't meet the way walls and floors are supposed to, and Chef has fallen into a chasm. He picks himself up off the sticky floor, seemingly unhurt, just as the horrors round the bend into full view. Why do they all have to be so ugly? These goddamn things look like giant cockroaches, but standing upright as tall as a man. They're slightly hunched over, and their backs are covered by a slick black carapace. Their awful roach legs wave out in front of them, each ending with a patch of thick black hairs. Down near the bottom of their disgusting bodies is what looks like a huge barbed penis, at least 2 foot in length, maybe 3. I don't get a chance to look at them for long because the worst part of these roach creatures is their heads. Their heads are all jittering, twitching mandibles, waving antennae, and huge shiny eyes the color of rotted blood. Those are the roach heads. They've also got these baby heads, like human baby heads, jutting up from either side of their roach heads. These heads constantly ooze some kind of clear fluid or mucus out of their baby mouths. They're what's making the awful crying, cooing, and gurgling noises. There are at least 10 roachmen racing around the bend, but it's taking them forever to actually get to us. Fucking dimensions in this place. The angles are all fucked up. I lay down on my belly and reach my exposed hand down towards Chef. He reaches up, but there's too much distance between us.
"Go! Get the fuck out of here!"
Chef screams.
"You do not want to get caught by those things!"
"What are they?" I ask, disgusted, still trying to will my arm to be just a little longer, as though I'd be able to haul up 350 pounds of cook, even if I could reach him. Still, I have to try.
"Berserkers!" Chef says, looking terrified. "They're like sentries. They roam these halls, eating, fucking, and killing anything they come across. Not always in that order."
Chef backs away, pulling out his yellow stone.
"Now, kid, go! I'm not telling you again!"
I stand back up. "We'll hold them off. You find a way out of there," I say, preparing to engage the roach things as they finally get close enough to smell. I take a deep breath through my nose and wish I hadn't. They smell like cat piss covered in fish guts after it's been left in the sun to rot all day. It should have made me gag, but by now, I'm used to all these twisted monsters and their shitty smells.
"Like hell!"
Chef yells back.
"You and the crippled girl's gonna hold off 10 of those things? You best grab her and run, boy, for those monsters fuck you to death. I'm not leaving you, I start. But Chef blurts out a short chant and points the star thing at me, knocking me back a dozen feet. I land on my ass, right in front of Karen and Ty, just as the roach creatures reach the corner Chef is stuck in. My armor is smoking and smells like burnt hair and dog shit, but it's still intact. I'm gasping, trying to catch my breath. My chest feels like I've been shot. Several of the roach monsters are already clambering into the chasm, trying to get to our big black buddy. Get up, Karen yells. We can't leave him down there. They'll kill him. Chef starts hollering and jumping up and down, attracting the attention of all but one of them. He fires off a chant, blasting the head clean off the first roach monster, plastering its companions in thick white goop. Its corpse falls into the weird chasm. Chef blasts two more, each landing on top of the last. Come on, Karen yells. Wait, look, he's building a goddamn ramp out of their bodies. He's gonna get out. My celebration is cut short as the roach thing, not distracted by Chef's yelling, reaches us, flailing its hairy legs and jutting its giant penis. I jump forward and prepare to attack. A hairy leg slashes at my face. If it weren't for my sniffer helmet, my head would have been sliced clean off. The hairs covering its multi-segmented legs are razor sharp. My helmet falls away in several pieces. I stumble backward as the big roach charges forward, intent on finishing the job, its baby head sobbing all the while. Just as it rears back to attack again, a huge sniffer stinger strikes from the right, outside my peripheral vision, impaling the left baby head and the roach head while barely missing the baby head on the right, covering me in noxious white roach guts that smell like rotten milk. The blow is enough to cripple the disgusting monster, though, and now it hangs limp off Karen's makeshift weapon, its remaining head bawling like a newborn being drowned in a wash basin. The weight of the giant bug is too much for her skinny, atrophied legs. She drops to one knee, threatening to topple over altogether. A little help here, she pants, using all her strength to keep from being crushed by the monster. I try to yank it free from Karen's weapon, but it won't budge. I crawl underneath it and lay on my back, hoping I can push it free with my leg strength. Push! I grunt, but it's no use. The limp creature just hangs there, crushing down on top of us. It must weigh 300 pounds. Ricky, Karen says. She's got a weird look in her eye.
I have something I have to tell you.
Oh, brother, like I need more of this shit right now. I know, I say breathlessly, still shoving against the dead weight above me. You're in love with me. Yeah, I've heard it before. Listen, I hate to break it to you, babe, but... What? She asks, confused, even sounding a little offended. I start to speak when the remaining baby head attached to the paralyzed roach body vomits a torrent of vile-fetid seawater onto my face for my troubles. I choke and gag simultaneously as I try to blow the rancid water out of my nose. And still, I can't budge the hulking roach's body. That's when I hear Ty cry out from behind us. Ty! I cough out. Get this thing off us! I look back to see if he hears me. He's just standing there, a few feet away. His eyes are glazed over and he's shivering. He looks like he's got a fever. The swelling in his arm and throat are somehow even worse. His face looks fat now, obese. Ty! I yell again. This time I get his attention. His eyes focus. He looks at me and opens his mouth to speak. Instead of words, dozens of mice-sized sniffers pour from between his lips. He tries to scream, but more and more of the little bugs are fighting their way out of his mouth. When his throat constricts, they start to sting him from the inside. He drops to his knees. His throat swells to the size of a watermelon right before my eyes. He starts to stab at it with the full-size stinger attached to his arm to try to let the tiny monsters out so he can breathe. Blood and sniffers rush from the wound. He stuffs his free hand into the gash and pulls out handfuls of the writhing little beasts. He takes two ragged, wet breaths from the gaping wound before his breath hitches and he freezes, eyes wide. A moment later, he shrieks and his eyeballs roll up into the back of his head. He rips at them with his fingers as some unseen force bursts them from their moorings. Blood and brains pour from his ears. After his eyeballs are gone, his hands grow up to a small crack in his forehead. Little writhing tentacles dart in and out of the crack, fighting their way free. Using the stinger attached to his hand, he tries to bore into the crack to let the baby monsters out of his skull. He screams all the while. Finally, after too many moments, his entire head explodes, sending baby sniffers, brains, and gore 5 feet into the air. Only then does the screaming stop. As Ty's headless body thumps lifelessly to the floor, I do my best to cover Karen from the rain of bug monsters and gore that splatters over us while still trying to hold up the paralyzed body of the roach thing threatening to crush us. In no time, I feel the snipper's little squirming body start to crawl through the cracks in my armor. Get this fucking thing off me, I scream, redoubling my efforts to push away the roach monster. I'm starting to freak out pretty hard. The baby snippers are already crawling up Karen's legs, too. They're all over us. They'll start to sting us at any moment, and we'll end up like Ty, too. Karen knows this as well as I do, and that's all the incentive she needs. I feel the snippers rooting around on my clothes, under my armor, trying to find exposed skin. Panicking, I start to hyperventilate as I look down and see a little sniffer poke out from my chest plate and make its way up toward my bare neck. Come on! Come on! I whine. Karen glances over and sees the baby sniffer prodding around my neck, slowly crawling up to my face. She curses under her breath. Using her free hand to pull the slack out of the sniffer tendons that hold the armor to her body, she uses her teeth to tear knots out of the binding. Within seconds, she's free of her stinger weapon still lodged in the roach heads. Able to use both hands and put her whole body weight behind her, she's able to topple the monster over, freeing us both just as the baby sniffer pries open my pursed lips with its four tentacles and tries to make its way inside. I bite its head off and climb to my feet, tossing the decapitated little body away before it can sting me. Karen and I both dance out of our armor as fast as we can, knocking little bug monsters off each other's backs as fast as we can, then stomping them flat before they can crawl up our shoes again. Satisfied that we're bug-free, I point at the corner, still infested with giant cockroaches. We gotta get Shep out of that pit! We take off running, leaving the paralyzed roach monster to wail as the baby sniffers sting its face over and over until it's so swollen it can no longer make its hideous noise. I almost trip over the edge and pitch myself down into the chasm when we run up to it. My brain still can't comprehend the angles in this fucking place. Karen catches me and we both gasp as we look down into the pit and see what lies down there. I finally do throw up and Karen starts to cry. Dead roach monsters litter the chasm. Their bodies lay exploded in all manner of dismemberment. Some still twitch, some still bleed. Cooked white goo turned a nasty yellow steams up from the floor, covering it as well as most of the surface of the walls. There are enough corpses piled up in the corner for Chef to climb out. Unfortunately, Chef won't be doing any more climbing. The berserkers, as he called them, are literally fucking the shit out of him, and then eating it. Chef's stomach is all torn open. He's laying on his back. His guts are all messed up and looped out across his wounded belly and chest. There are two berserkers left alive. The roach's huge cocks are thrusting in and out of Chef's steaming entrails, their baby heads gurgle crying the whole time. Worse, when one of Chef's intestines bursts open, the roaches use their forelimbs to scoop up the bloody shit into their jittering, chopping little mouth parts. I think he's dead at first, till he lifts his head up and looks at me with his one good eye, the other having presumably been fucked out of his skull.
Come on, Karen sobs. Let's just go. Let's get the fuck out of this awful place.
She grabs me by the arm and tries to pull me away.
No!
I yank free and start to stumble down the roach corpses.
Ricky, there's nothing you can do for him. We've got to go before something else tries to kill us.
This is all my fault, I say. The callous prick who so easily dropped an axe into his best friend's head, nowhere to be found. All I can think about is Chef's robust laughter as he stood at the grill station at McHuman's making fun of us white people. Seeing him down in that death pit, his body so heinously violated, something inside me snaps. I'm shaking all over, probably in shock, as I try to make my way down the bodies of the dead berserkers. Chef raises his hand to stop me. He closes his eyes and shakes his head at me.
Fuck out of here, boy. Take that white girl. Get as far away from Raleigh as you can. This ain't no place for good people.
With that, Chef raises his star thing up to his own face and barks out one final chant, blasting his own head into pink mush. I stumble out of the pit, numb. The remaining berserkers are already pulling their dicks free of Chef's corpse. They'll be on us in moments. Without armor or weapons, Karen and I are defenseless. I can't bring myself to care. The weight of the events inside this monstrous tomb crushing down on top of me, obliterating my ability to think rationally. When I get back up off the floor, Karen stands stiff, looking past me with wide eyes. I turn to see what she's looking at. Fishbowl is just a few yards away, the hands of its wetsuit clenched into fists. I step in front of Karen instinctively.
What are you doing here?
I ask, confused. I take one last swig from my bottle, draining its contents before discarding it onto the stone floor. You're supposed to be at the banquet with the food. With Fishbowl stalking toward me and berserkers about to attack from the rear, I'm surprisingly calm. Resigned to my fate, I'm ready to die. So it comes as a shock when I hear Karen say, in a small voice from behind me, "I'm so sorry, Ricky." And that's the last thing I remember. I guess Karen hit me in the head with something and knocked me out, because the next thing I knew, I was hanging here, upside down, staring at your rotten, ugly fucking face, Mr. Cthulhu. By the look of the seething throng of slaves far below the grand platform that loomed above Great Cthulhu's banquet hall, every last living human in the flooded world had been gathered in deep relay to witness the coming of the Old Ones. They'd been herded into a semicircular area that resembled the floor of the great Roman Colosseum, except instead of dirt or sand on the ground, they stood on the same damp, slimy gray stones that made up the rest of Weird Relay. Madness seethed through the crowd in waves as the alien angles proved too much for their small human minds to comprehend. Depending where they stood or where they cast their eyes, the huge spiraling pillar upon which Great Cthulhu sat seemed to rise hundreds of feet in the air and other times to plunge far below them. But no matter which direction they looked, the masses of starved, broken, defeated humans saw hideous, unfathomable beasts in all manner of shapes, sizes, colors, and genders. The monsters towered over the feeble vestige of humanity, perched atop a huge stone grandstand surrounding Great Cthulhu's spiral pillar, giving them a marvelous view of the day's events. Slimy grinners, fang-toothed barkers, many-faced howlers, jittery spinners, and hordes of wet things that defied any sane description jeered at the human slaves standing below them and praised the old gods far above. Even now, miles overhead or down below, depending on the angle, ancient Yog-Sothoth shifted patiently between dimensions, slowly opening the doorways into an unimaginable number of between places, the places where the Old Ones dwelt, silently waiting for this moment. Its gargantuan, jellyfish-like body appeared and disappeared into the beautiful, unearthly color that drove sane men to tear out their eyeballs and jam sharp objects between their ears. It was a beautiful sight, but not the main attraction. Soon enough, the jeering monsters and the hysterical humans all quieted down as the host of the evening's events took center stage in front of Great Cthulhu's humongous stone throne. All eyes were on the figure as he raised his hands, commanding the attention of all in attendance. The figure was, of course, Narelhotep, the personification of the Old Ones and mouthpiece of the Elder Gods. He stood, in this incarnation, a tall, slender black man. Not dark-skinned, black-skinned. He looked like a shadow, a dense, colorless smear against the light. The only part of his body not resigned to the inky blackness were his eyes, which glowed a preternatural white against the darkness, and the red of his lips and mouth like a fresh wound, a gash sliced into his obsidian, featureless face. His voice boomed out, carried by the weird angles inside the huge domed subterranean lair of Cthulhu, the nightmare amphitheater beneath sunken relay that served as his banquet hall.
"We've won!" he exclaimed. "The world is ours! Humanity's final vestige tremble before us, broken and mad!"
He gestured to the slave pit, where the humans stood shamed, covered in filth, dressed in the tattered remnants of their short reign on planet Earth. The throng of monsters cheered, whooping and jeering toward the slave pit.
"And yet,"
Narelhotep said, motioning for silence from the crowd,
"even as we stand on this glorious precipice, mere moments before the return of all the Old Ones, after their precious planet has been annihilated, flooded, wiped clean of the human scourge, one stands among them who would defy the might of this world's true leaders."
Ricky spun slowly, hung upside down with his arms tied behind his back, just above Cthulhu's throne. He hung from a rope fashioned to the clawed tip of one of the hulking beast's dragon-like wings. He was nearly bored to tears by the shadow creature's pompous speech, almost wishing the damn thing would shut up and kill him already. After all,
With Karen selling him out to the Deep Ones, he was all but fucked anyway. That wasn't really what he wanted, though. He had one more trick up his sleeve to kill the monsters and unplug the drain that would unflood the world. But it was a long shot. A very long shot. Cthulhu looked bored as well. His bulbous, green, whale-like chest rose up and down slowly. His many-tentacled head rested on one hand, propped up by his elbow, which rested on the arm of his throne. His beady little black fish eyes were open but unfocused. His enormous wings hung limp, slowly swaying in time with the gargantuan monster's deep breathing. For all Ricky knew, the big fucker was sleeping through his trial. Fishbowl stood a few feet away, holding Karen by the arms. Karen, for her part, looked embarrassed and remorseful. Not that any of that mattered now. The deed was done. She chose monsters over people. A typical woman, aligned only with what best served to save her own ass. Even Boss Crab was there, standing next to Fishbowl and Karen, looking surprised by the turn of events. Behind them stood the pair of hulking leviathans that had transported all the poisoned food, which now lay in a heaping pile beside them. Encircling the entire platform were more than a dozen empty thrones, just as big as the one on which Cthulhu now sat. For the other important monsters, Ricky guessed. The ones they were going to summon right after they killed him.
He thought he could poison our food!
Nyarlathotep continued, smirking up at Ricky with his crimson slit of a mouth.
Thought he could prevent the inevitable! But the stars are right, my friends, and our time is now! This little deceiver, the shadow figure said, prancing up to Karen. This one betrayed her entire race! She didn't just betray them, she was downright happy about it! This little trooper ran right to her boss crab the moment she got wind of her friend's pathetic scheme to prevent the return of the old ones!
The contingent of monsters laughed and scoffed, while the enslaved humans murmured amongst themselves. Nyarlathotep silenced them.
Should this one live? Should her betrayal be rewarded?
Half the crowd of monsters booed, the other half cheered. The humans stood in silence, malevolent faces worn by all.
Come now,
the Shadow Man said, feigning concern.
For her loyalty to the Deep Ones, shouldn't she be allowed to witness the coming of the ages, the return of the gods from the dark? She did, after all, warn us about her friend's plot to contaminate all of this.
Nyarlathotep frowned and paused dramatically.
Wonderful food!
This time nearly all of the monsters cheered, while the slaves vocalized their disgust in the form of curses and vile insults hurled at the red-headed young woman. She looked up at Ricky with tears flowing freely down her face.
Oh, so, so sorry.
She lives!
Nyarlathotep screamed with delight.
For now,
he added with a smirk.
But what about him?
The shadow figure said, dramatically stabbing a finger upward at Ricky.
What do we do with the rebel slave who thought he could poison Great Cthulhu himself?
The crowd of undersea aliens booed and hissed, dramatically condemning the captured man.
Death?
Nyarlathotep asked, as if he didn't already know the outcome of this silly show. Ricky was being made an example of, a warning for the few remaining humans never to try a stunt like this again. And that's exactly what Ricky had hoped would happen. A roaring chant of death, death, death echoed through the vast banquet chamber. Even jellyfish-like Yogg-Sothoth seemed to pulse in time with the deafening taunt. The only horrible figure not screaming death at the top of its lungs, or gills, or whatever means they used to make sound, was Great Cthulhu, who still sat bored at his throne, carelessly twitching his face tentacles, waiting for the shenanigans to be over.
Death it is!
The Shadow Man yelled, prancing back and forth directly under Ricky. For a split second, the captive considered spitting on the monster below him, then thought better of it. For his plan to work, Ricky needed to remain as limp and non-threatening as possible.
How do we kill him?
Nyarlathotep asked, in the same nonchalant tone he might use to inquire about the time of day.
Come on,
Ricky said under his breath.
Should we skin him alive and serve him his own cooked flesh?
The monsters roared in approval. The shadowy figure was nearly skipping with glee as he ticked off horrible ways for Ricky to die.
Burn him alive and then drown him? Should we drown him and then burn him?
Ricky broke out in a cold sweat. This was not what he planned for.
I've got it. Let's cut out his intestines and hang him with them. Or,
the Shadow Man said, dramatically holding one finger in the air, cut off his fingers and toes, and then his hands and feet, and then his arms and legs, and then cut out his eyeballs, and then slice off his tongue, and then cut out his ears. Narelhotep continued, hardly pausing for breath, getting more and more worked up with each sadistic idea. If Ricky didn't put a stop to this now, he'd never get his chance. "Hey, douchebag!" he yelled, when the figure below had finally stopped talking, long enough to receive a standing ovation from the demoniac creatures in attendance. Narelhotep glanced up at Ricky, bemused smile on his face.
"It seems as though the brave little human finally has something to say."
He waved the crowd to silence as they began to protest. "No, no, no. Let's hear him out. It'll be the last thing he ever says." Ricky hesitated, spinning slowly.
"Well?"
Narelhotep said, becoming annoyed. "Eat me, you sanctimonious, shit-stained-looking cunt." For a moment, Narelhotep stared at his prisoner. His form began to change shape, seeming to grow in mass. The corners of his arms and legs bulged out, and his head took on feral properties. A low growl formed in his throat, and suddenly he resembled the shadow of a gigantic bear more than that of a man. Then, just as suddenly, his form snapped back to that of a tall, thin man.
"Eat you! Yes! Yes!"
The shadow man jumped up into the air with excitement, as though the revelation was the best idea of the entire evening.
"Perfect! Eat him! What do you say, gang? Should the great Cthulhu eat this defiant little pest alive to show his fellow monkey men that you do not fuck with the elder gods? Let him stew in the boiling stomach acids of he who shall herald their return, clinging to his final moments of life while we bring forth the supreme rulers of this dimension?"
The ensuing cacophony of supportive cries from the nightmare contingent was deafening. More than one of the human slaves flung themselves against the cold, slimy stones until they bashed their own brains out in order to escape the monstrous jubilation.
"A tribute, then, to the coming of the grand masters of this reality!"
Narelhotep exclaimed. And finally, Great Cthulhu stirred from his throne, reached out, and plucked Ricky off the dangling rope with no more effort or care than yanking a grape from the vine. The enormous octopoid's face tentacles quivered in anticipation for the bite-sized meal they were about to receive. The longest of the dozen tendrils licked across Ricky's face, leaving a wet, drippy smear in its wake. Ricky took a deep breath and closed his eyes. "This had better fucking work," he said to himself, silently willing his final, desperate plan into motion. Doubt crept into the young man's mind when he opened his eyes again as Cthulhu opened his seemingly fathomless maw, revealing innumerable smaller tendrils laced with razor-sharp teeth running down and down, further and further into the behemoth creature's gullet.
"I don't want to fucking die," Ricky screamed inside his own head. "Holy fucking shit, I'm fucking dunzos! Wait!"
Relief rushed through the captive human as this momentary reprieve gained him another precious few seconds of life. He looked down to see who'd interrupted his impending execution. Boss Crab stood directly beneath him, looking more astonished than usual.
"You have to tell me,"
the unblinking crustacean said.
"After everything, was it worth it?"
Ricky glanced around the huge banquet hall, took in all of the horrific monsters gathered around to witness his demise, looked out into the sea of human faces, each and every one of them in awe that one man could stand so defiantly against the madness and futility before them. He looked back at the great Cthulhu about to swallow him whole, and back down at the small group standing on the platform with him. He let his gaze linger for an extra moment on Karen and Fishbowl standing behind Boss Crab, and then he smiled, setting his sights back on his former boss. "I'll tell you in a minute."
"What?"
Boss Crab asked, puzzled. But then it was too late to ask any more questions. Great Cthulhu finally spoke, his voice a terrible echoing boom that scattered Ricky's brain and made it hard for him to focus his thoughts, almost as though 1,000 tiny wasps stung his consciousness all at once.
"Enough!"
the giant beast roared, and with that, he tossed Ricky into the air, letting his face tentacles grab the tiny human, no more than the size of a toy truck to the awesome monster, and stuffed the captive man into his expansive throat. Karen cried out and dropped to her knees. Narelhotep let out a whoop of joy. Boss Crab looked stunned by the whole thing. And Fishbowl stood ever silent, staring straight ahead.
And we are back, gang. That was some fucked up shit, wasn't it,
James? Yes, it was.
Karen double crosses the gang. Fucking poor Ty explodes.
Can't trust bitches.
No, you can't. If there's one thing Kevin Strange Fiction will teach you, gang, and all through one of the themes that runs throughout my fiction is that bitches can't be trusted. Bitches be crazy. Chef gets eaten alive by a baby-headed cockroach monster. Yes. Ty explodes in a fury of little baby scorpions, lobster monsters. It's very, very gory. There's a real tense segment. I loved writing this segment where the dead body of the cockroach monster actually falls onto Ricky and Karen, and at the exact moment that Ty explodes, and so they've got the little lobster crab or lobster scorpion monsters crawling on them, about to sting them, and it's this real tense moment of like Ricky trying to get the fucking body of the roach monster off of him before they get attacked by the little babies. It's very, very cool. And then of course Karen backstabs Ricky, and she gives them over to Fishbowl, who's the right hand man of Mr. Krabs.
Man?
Their employer.
Did you assume it's gender?
I did assume it's gender, and we will find out if that was a mistake or not later in the fourth segment of the thing. So then we, of course, cut to the banquet, Cthulhu's big production. We get to meet Nyarlathotep, who I like to write about. I've written about Nyarlathotep several times. I'm actually writing a... you remember the clown fiasco from last... it's hard to remember all the different stupid things that happened on the internet.
Like
right before the election nonsense started, there were supposed real killer clowns.
My daughter was totally sucked into that at school, and I kept telling her, I'm a juggalo. If there was real killer clowns, trust me, I'd know.
We'd know.
We'd probably know who they were.
Yeah, so then that just vanished. November 1st, literally the day after Halloween, that was no longer an issue to discuss. I'm actually in the middle of writing a novella about the killer clowns and why they disappeared right after Halloween, why nobody's ever seen or heard from them since. Because I suspect that Halloween this year, they're going to be back. So I'm going to release that book around Halloween. Why was I talking about this book?
Never wrote that.
Oh, yeah, and it ends up being a Lovecraftian story that involves Nyarlathotep is actually behind the killer clowns, which you'll find out. And I've written about him. I wrote about him in The Last Gig on Planet Earth, the novella.
Yeah, you did.
The rock and roll novella. I just like Nyarlathotep because he's the herald of the old ones, and he appears in human form. But he also has an otherworldly form that's a tentacly golden squid monster. Like there's just so many. A lot of the Lovecraft gods don't have a lot to them. They're like one dimensional. They have a thing they do. They look like a certain thing, and then that's it. Nyarlathotep really has a personality and a lot of different ways.
I enjoyed the voice you used for him in this story when we were recording. Yeah. It was great.
I wanted him to be like a carnival barker.
Yeah.
Because again, he's the herald of the old ones, so why wouldn't he be a carnival barker?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he's like addressing the crowd, and the crowd is all these otherworldly monsters, and the slave humans are all gathered around in the banquet hall. I mean, you guys just listen to it. You know, you know what happened, but that was a lot of fun to write. But there are more twists and turns to come next week. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, I was waiting for him to go. Can you dig it?
Yeah. but let's talk about where this fucking whole thing came from to begin with, the origins of McHumans. So when I made my jump from making movies to writing fiction. If you go back and watch my movies, even though they're ridiculous sex stoner comedy horror movies, no budget schlockfests, I do throw back to Lovecraft a lot. I have my own version of the Necronomicon in there called the Black Mage Diary, and they do call to the old ones, and there are a lot of like Lovecraftian references because I've been a fan of Lovecraftian fiction since I was a teenager. Been obsessed with H.P. Lovecraft, the H.P. Lovecraft movies by Stuart Gordon and Brian Yuzna, and Lovecraft's fiction, but also offshoot mythos fiction by guys like Brian Lumley and the like. Even Stephen King has some Lovecraftian fiction. And so I've always known that there was this sandbox that you could write in. That's kind of one of the first things we learn about as fans of Lovecraft, is that August Derleth and Arkham House were kind of instructed when they put Lovecraft's fiction back into market after he died, that they were instructed by him in his estate to allow anyone to write any of these stories. So there's a difference between, like, H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard were very close friends. Robert E. Howard is the creator of Conan, and Lovecraft is the creator of Cthulhu, of course. Well, the Howard estate, they don't let anyone write Conan. You can't write Conan stories. Those are copyrighted. You are not allowed to...
You can't be in that specific world.
You can't write a barbarian. You can write barbarian. I mean, he popularized... Well, one of the reasons that Howard spawned the sword and sorcery genre of barbarian fiction is because people couldn't write about Conan himself.
Yeah.
The reason Lovecraft spawned a bunch of Lovecraftian fiction... What's called Lovecraftian fiction. You don't have Conanian fiction or Sumerian fiction. There's Conan the Sumerian.
Yeah.
You know, you were able to do that with Lovecraft and create Lovecraftian fiction, work with Cthulhu and Nyarlathotep and Yog-Sothoth and Wilbur Waitley and all those different colorful characters from Lovecraft's mythos. You were able to do all that because it's all public domain work. And one of the questions we actually got from a reader or from a listener of the podcast, he wanted us to talk about what would happen to the cottage industry of Lovecraftian fiction if this stuff wasn't public domain. And I think I just answered that if Lovecraft had copyrighted his work, you wouldn't be able to write about Cthulhu, and you wouldn't be able to write about Nyarlathotep, but it would have spawned and there is a greater cosmic horror genre that doesn't, you know, there are people that like to write about the style and the kind of universe that Lovecraft created without, like, by adding their own stuff to it without actually talking about Lovecraft's characters.
I think it would just be detrimental to Lovecraft himself. Like you said, it would have just been the cosmic horror genre rather than the Lovecraftian.
And
you've kind of seen that with Tolkien.
Right. Yes. Tolkien also. You couldn't write about hobbits, but you could write about high fantasy.
Yeah. But it's still bled out. They're still orcs.
Yes.
You know, it's one of those things.
Orcs and elves and...
It's like
and,
Kleenex. Once you've copyrighted something, yeah, sure, other people can't use it, but people in the society say that...
Find a way. And there's a lot to be said for that. Because think about the sword and sorcery genre, the high fantasy genre. Because people were restricted and not able to actually write those creators' actual characters, it spawned these huge universes that, like, look at Game of Thrones, the Song of Fire and Ice. That wouldn't exist without, I would arguably say both of those genres. The high fantasy and sword and sorcery is kind of Song of Fire and Ice is kind of an amalgamation of both of those.
Yeah,
so I mean, thanks to Tolkien and thanks to
But Robert we don't Howard. Say Tolkien.
Yeah,
we say Lovecraftian.
We say Lovecraftian because
So I think
we
it's
can't.
Just detrimental to the original artist.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like Tolkien's estate's hurting or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
But you think he could have had a whole genre of fiction named after him if he would have did
So I would say that to answer the fan question for the week, and if you have any other fan questions that you would, if you hear us talk about stuff on the podcast, hear me make references, or I want to ask specific questions about the fiction itself, the stories that we read here on the show, you can contact Jeremy at facebook.com/readingtostrangers, and we will read fan questions and we'll answer fan questions on the air. In fact, that would be a great segment if you guys would throw in a lot of questions. If you guys would get real active with us and communicate with us, we would love to have a segment every week where we answer fan questions. That's a pipe dream right now, but we would love to get there and you know, do a whole segment on that. That would be great. So to answer the fan question of the week, what would happen to the cottage industry of Lovecraftian fiction had his work been copyrighted? I think it would just be called something else.
Yeah, it's fiction. People wouldn't understand who started it.
Right.
And like I said, it's just
most people know. Most people have never heard of Robert E. Howard, but everybody's heard of Conan.
Yeah.
So when I made that move from writing, from making movies to writing fiction, Lovecraft was one of the first things I wanted to play in that sandbox. I wanted to play in that sandbox since I knew I could. I wanted to try my hand at Lovecraftian fiction. And so when I started the publishing house, I had two big tent poles that I knew I wanted to create. I wanted to create a sex anthology, and I wanted to create a Lovecraftian anthology. And we went the route with the sex anthology first, and we'll talk about the origins of that, where that came from, why I did that, why I wrote the story I wrote when we do the month that will encompass the weird novella about furries and shit in my novella Cotton Candy, which we'll do a couple months down the road. Maybe that'll be the April show or the May show. And we'll talk about the origins of the Strange Sex Anthology and why I went that route, why that was the first anthology we did. But one of the next anthologies that we did for the publishing house was Strange versus Lovecraft. And that was, the whole reason for that was I wanted to try my hand, but I also wanted to get a bizarro take on Lovecraft fiction from other bizarro writers, because I looked around and I didn't see, there were some individual authors who had tackled the hybrid of bizarro and Lovecraftian fiction, but to this day, has there ever been a Lovecraftian bizarro mashup anthology other than the one that
put out? Not that I remember. I mean, got my pulse on the industry or anything, but I haven't heard anything or seen anything like that.
There's a lot of anthologies.
But we kind of came out with the thunder on that one. We had one of the biggest Lovecraftian writers contribute to that.
We were able to get Willem Pugmire. We were able to get a good story out of him. And I actually asked a bunch of other of the big kind of names in Lovecraftian fiction, and I wanted it to be Strange versus Lovecraft. The reason I called the anthology that was because I wanted half the stories to be traditional Lovecraftian stories from some heavy hitters, and then us up-and-coming bizarro authors actually, you know, as a response to traditional Lovecraftian horror, as the new wave bizarro Lovecraftian horror. And while that completely failed because none of the Lovecraftian authors were interested in doing business with us, even when I offered them quite a bit of money to write stories for us, we were able to get Willem Pugmire, and so we just kind of started the anthology off with his story and said, this is indicative of traditional Lovecraft fiction. We love it, and this is a send-up. Mm-hmm. This is the bizarro send-up to the genre we love. So everything from here on out is going to be crazy bizarro takes on the Lovecraft genre, Lovecraftian horror. And I to this day I stand behind that that anthology. I think it turned out great. That's where the original version of McHumans showed up, which is why we're talking about it. And that was the version that did not have the meat portal ritual scene in it. And again, the reason that I wanted to do that was Lovecraft has a big name, and the goal for my first year as a publisher was to put out a bunch of hard hitting anthologies that would attract eyeballs to us, even though nobody knew who we were. You know, I came at this game very deliberately. I already had a career. I already knew how to market. I already knew how to sell stuff, and so I came to this with a very, very, very serious game face on. And I wanted to put out provocative, eye-catching books that would just hit right away without anybody having to know who we were as individual authors. And boy, did we pull that off in spades. And this Lovecraft anthology, I think, is one of the... To this day, I stand very proud of that.
I mean, just on cover art alone... we got the only one that I heard more when we were out on the road was Strange Sex and It's a Hot Girl. You're gonna get a little, you know,
sure,
a little more attention towards that.
And we'll talk about
people were just shocked about the cover art. And for the cover artist, ended up being way more, you know, getting blown up himself. I get his name's
escaping. Chris Hammer is his name.
Yeah, Chris Hammer. But yeah, he started doing Star Wars cards, Mars Attacks cards for big things, and I was like, wow, he's crazy. He went on,
and I've said this many times, for all the hate that Kevin Strange gets from the Bizarro community because I don't no-toe to Portland, we helped launch the careers of a lot of people with our publishing house. We, for a couple of years there, we were the hottest thing on the fucking market, man. And that's a testament to what I brought to the table, what Jeremy Daniels brought to the table, and what Sean Ferrari brought to the table as an editor, because he made sure that those books came out. No book is ever going to be error-free, but Sean Ferrari worked his fucking balls off to make sure that we, even though we were, you know, just upstarts, just getting going in this industry, that we had legitimate fiction. He was a very meticulous editor, and the downfall of a lot of other upstart publishing houses or pseudo publishing houses was their complete lack of editing ability.
Well, man, that's still an issue from what I've seen, because one of the editors at the time that another person used before Sean got to review that work, it didn't seem like he was even close to what Ferrari was doing. Ferrari's meticulous and going and picking through and really trying to understand the subject matter as well as
what a lot of so-called editors who have achieved very high positions in Bizarro fiction, they have no interest in grammar and function. They are only interested in pushing their own personal opinion on writers.
Yeah.
So all they want to do is read your work and tell you what sucks about it, and that's not editing.
No.
Sean was a badass editor. Well, I said was. He is. He's editing my new book right now. He's still a current editor. But I think part of the reason that he's so good is because his ego plays no role in his work as an editor. He is not now and has never been part of any writing community.
Yeah.
He works for us, and he only works for us, and he works for us because he believes in what we're doing.
Man. He does all the grammar and everything right up front. And then, you know, he will talk about consistency and how the stuff flows, but he never tries to change the story.
No.
You know, if he says something doesn't make sense, he doesn't say, well, you should do this, you should do that.
No. Ironically, and I'll never let him live this down, the one story of all these years, all this fiction, all these books, all these short stories, he told me, Kevin, I have to be honest with you. This Jorek and the Shaga Steel story, it's not as good as... It's not up to your normal standards. This is a crappy-ass story. And I was like, oh, man, this is my first story. And we'll talk more about that the Barbarian Month of March. But I thought it was funny that ended up becoming one of the... It is the most popular story in the in All the Toxic Waste from My Heart, which is where it originally appeared in that short story collection. It ended up being the most popular story in there, so I can't let him live that down. We'll talk more about that next month in Barbarian Month. But yeah, I just wanted to really reiterate just how much of a role Sean played in not only those first couple of anthologies, but every book we put out as a publishing house was so well received in that first couple of years. Due in no small part to his hard work and your hard work and my hard work.
Throughout that whole time we were working together, maybe three or four times somebody picked an insignificant thing out of a book and said, oh, look, this is, you know, that's amazing. If you think about how much actual shit we put out.
And again, one of the death knells of up and coming publishing houses and pseudo publishing houses is that they can't get their act together with their publishing or with their editing. They'll publish, you know, they'll have somebody do editing work and then accidentally publish the pre-editing version of it. They will
it's in Turkish,
or they'll just have people that have no business fucking editing call themselves an editor and then claim to have, you know, edited the book. They put it out, and the books get fucking 1- and 2-star reviews because the grammar is fucking, you know, the grammar and function is awful. And so that, you know, again, I have to get, we would not have gotten as far as we did, and I wouldn't still be sitting here doing a fucking fiction podcast with you, Jeremy Daniels, all these years later if it wasn't for Sean's hard work.
Yeah, so, if you had me editing.
Yeah, if I had the dumbass idea of calling myself an editor. Like, I've never called myself an editor. I've done a few editing jobs. Like, I do, I've done a couple of writing classes online, and where I do like an hour lecture a week. It's like a 4-week class. I do an hour lecture, and then at the end of the class, I edit a story that you write. The editing the story that the students write is my least favorite part of the whole thing, because I'm not an editor, so I mean, I can only do so much. My strength is lecturing. I can tell you how to write a story.
Your strength is talking?
Yeah.
That's odd.
I can tell you how to write.
We're discovering new things this week on Reading is Great.
Yeah. I can tell you how to write a story, but as far as an editor, I would never put myself in the role of an editor. And I think a lot of these guys do it because they lack creativity. They lack the ability to participate in this genre or the writing community in general in any other way. So they slap the term editor on themselves, and they just do a disservice to authors. So as a final lesson here in the origins of McHumans as a story, I haven't really talked about McHumans. So let me make this point, and then we'll try to get a little bit into the meat of why I wrote McHumans and stuff like that.
Well, we've got a little bit, but we'll give you more than just the tip, maybe a little more shaft.
But as an up and coming author, or if you're trying to start a publishing house, don't even attempt it without a great editor. Without someone you can trust. Not your mom, not your girlfriend or wife, not your buddy. Find a goddamn editor. You know, Sean came to me and said, I like your writing, but your grammar is fucking pathetic and you need help and I want to help. You know, he came to me and I said, well, you can try. And I didn't know if he was any good or not. And he turned out to be great. And so you got to have that.
Yeah, to the point he should be doing it full time.
He should. Money. He really should. And I hope that one day he'll get to do that. You know, I keep telling him, like, if Kevin Strange becomes a success to the point that I can make a living, a legitimate living off of this, you guys are going to also. I have no intention of doing this without you guys. And, being able to get you guys onto this train with me is one of my motivating factors of why I do it. And people can call me a piece of shit in the bizarre community all they want to.
You're talking about success train, not any other guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if you guys.
Three dudes, so just saying.
You know, there's one lady in there, then it's a 3-on-1. It's kind of hot, isn't it?
I don't know.
What's the
I prefer 2 vaginas to 1 dick ratio in any kind of group sex.
All right. There you go.
But I'm greedy, I guess.
Good. Yeah. That's those are fun, but I wouldn't necessarily reject the other side either. At least one vagina, though. Let's make.
At least one.
Right. So McHumans was really one of those things where it was kind of one of the first stories where I just let myself go for everything I wrote. Like when I wrote films, since I always knew I was working at a $500 or less budget, I always had to write very specifically. I had to write to my budget. And I had to write knowing where I could shoot. So I had to write to my locations. I had to write to my budget. I had to write to my actors' abilities. And so I would meticulously outline what I had to write, and then I would fill in from there. And when I first started writing fiction, I did for whatever reason, because it was how I taught myself to write. I did it the same way. I meticulously outlined where I wanted the story to go. Would fill in a summary of each scene. Like, I would write the number of scenes the book was going to have. Then I would do a summary of all the scenes, and then I would go fill in the rest and finish a book. And I found that by the time I was on that third pass, I was so fucking bored of just writing the, you know, functional prose into what amounted to a giant, fully formed outline. I found myself getting bored, and I wouldn't finish projects. And so with McHumans, I wanted to take a different approach to it. And so I didn't write any outline. I just sat down at the computer and I just wrote, whatever the opening line is. My name's Ricky. I'm a human being. I'm a survivor of the aquapocalypse. And that was all I knew. All I knew is this guy in a fucking, I don't remember if he's wearing a Dio or an Iron Maiden shirt, but he's wearing a heavy metal shirt. Yeah. and he's working in this shitty fast food restaurant under the sea, and that's all I knew. I had no idea where the story was going to go, and I haven't really been that ballsy since. McHumans is one of the only things I've ever written with absolutely no idea where the story was going to go. After next week, once we have the full conclusion, I'll actually talk about some things that happened in the book that surprised me, where I thought things were going to go in one direction and things ended up going in a completely different direction with the characters. Those characters, Ricky and Chef and Ty and Karen, they wrote this story. They informed where each scene was going to start and where each scene was going to end. I had no idea. So I just let their personalities play out. What would a guy like Ricky and what would a chick like Karen? And that's why when Karen double crosses him, I had no idea she was going to double cross him until that scene. So I was right there with that scene. Well, what happens next? Oh man, bitches be tripping. That's what happens next. This chick is going to double cross him and turn him into to Fishbowl. And it was a lot of fun to write it like that, man. It was super freeing, but I was scared to death too that I was writing a piece of crap. Because when I outline something, I can say, okay, here's the intro, here's the conflict, here's the rising action.
Well, it's also totally against a lot of the Kevin Strange beforehand writing, where all the little nuggets that you're dropping get all come together into one big.
It's hard to do callbacks to things that are going to happen later, the foreshadowing. It's hard to foreshadow a story when you don't fucking know what's going to happen later. Yeah. But as a writer, when I got to the later stages of the story, when I got to the climax and the resolution, I was able to say, well, I already know these things happen, so I'm going to create artificial call, but I didn't know I was foreshadowing.
Yeah, I'm just saying it was different than the way you traditionally wrote. Yeah. So it's going to definitely be harder to do it that way.
Yeah, it was just one of those things where I just wasn't sure. I can look at an outline when I write an outline. I've got a new novel that I'm getting ready to start here in the next month or so, and I've got the whole thing outlined. But I do very small outlines now. I don't do full summaries of scenes. I write out which scenes I think are going to exist and a little summary of bullet points, so that I know the intro, the conflict, the rising action, the climax, and the resolution, but only vaguely. And that can change at any given time. If you've taken my writing classes, you know I talk about how each scene and each each decision a character makes is it's like a cascading.
They can't see.
Yeah, I'm doing the magic fingers just to remind myself of the term, but it's like a cascading timeline where every decision can take the book on a whole new course, a whole new direction, and a lot of times that affects the future of the story and the past. I have to go back and alter things in the past to create that foreshadowing and to create those callbacks for later. And with McHumans, I just kind of grabbed my balls and went to work, and I think it turned out for something that was I guess you can call that improvised. For something that was basically improvised from start to finish, I think it turned out to be a pretty damn cool story.
Yeah, it's one of the first things we recorded together, and the hardest part about recording it was trying to keep from going, wow. Because yeah. I was reading along with him at that time. I didn't pre-read it.
Yeah.
And so, I was just like, wow, I can't do that. He's talking. Let's just be quiet.
Right, so... All right, so that's the origins of McHumans. It's gone on to be one of my best sellers. And here's another little tidbit for you. Well, no, we'll save that for next week because that kind of ruins the suspense of the ending of the story. So we will talk about how the McHumans universe connects to another Kevin Strange fictional universe at the end of next week's show. So what we have now, boy, old Cthulhu just ate Ricky.
Ruh-roh.
What's going to happen now?
I mean, most people would think this was the end.
But it's not. We still have a whole other week. We still have the whole climax and resolution of this story.
So, and it's not just 20 minutes of saying, I'm sorry, I ended it last week. I needed another episode and realized it was 4 weeks in February.
Well, so, gang, I hope you tune back in for the climax, the final battle, the showdown at the banquet in Cthulhu's Great Hall inside the sunken city of Relay. Will Ricky somehow survive? What will happen to Karen? And more. Double crosses.
Will somebody new be introduced?
More double crosses and swerves and all kinds of goodies. Lots of death. Next week on Reading to Strangers. Jeremy, do you have anything
Nope. I think we got it wrong.
All right. We will see you guys for the conclusion.
The conclusion.
Of the Inhumans next week. Remember, gang, keep reading.
All music featured on the Reading to Strangers podcast provided by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/.